Eat Drink Indiana Radio is powered by eatdrinkindy.com, where Central Indiana turns to learn about food from farm to fork and drink from grains to glass.
Drink Indiana Radio on WFYI HD2 The Point. I'm your host, Jolene Katzenberger. This week on Eat Drink Indiana Radio, we have got an interview with young Indianapolis cook Sabrina Richards, who will be at the Fantastic Food Fest this weekend at the Indiana State Fairgrounds. We'll also hear from chocolatier Julie Bolajak of Chocolate for the Spirit, also an exhibitor at the Fantastic Food Fest. And we'll also get the backstory on local entrepreneur Rita Franco of La Mexigringa. And we'll talk tenderloins with Rick Garrett of breadedtenderloin.wordpress.com. So stay with us for more here on Eat Drink Indiana Radio on WFYI and WFYI.org. Well, the Fantastic Food Fest comes to Indianapolis this weekend. You'll find this show and its exhibits, new product samples, and demos in the Champions Pavilion at the Indiana State Fairgrounds Saturday and Sunday. And you'll spot several food celebrities there as well, including Ted Allen of Chopped, Hugh Atchison of Top Chef, and Laurielle Gavin, the Butcher Babe from Food Network Star. Now, we had an interview here on Eat Drink Indiana Radio with Carmel native Ted Allen just last week, and we have talked to Laurielle Gavin in the past as well. But another local food personality will be at the Fantastic Food Fest. Sabrina Richards of Indianapolis appeared this past year on Rachel Ray's Kids Cook-Off, and you'll see the young cook doing a demo at the Fantastic Food Fest as well. I caught up with Sabrina during her run on Rachel Ray's Kids Cook-Off to have her do a bit of cooking here on the radio. In this segment, Sabrina takes our Cook This Challenge and creates a dish using a classic, duck confit, prepared by students at Ivy Tech's culinary program. As it turns out, duck is one of Sabrina's favorite ingredients, since she's a fan of French cooking, and especially of Julia Child. So what's your first thought when you think duck confit?
French.
Where would you go with that?
Probably something with a lot of herbs and some seasonings, and just very flavor-filled.
Okay, so I'll just sort of follow you around, and we'll see what you come up with. So what are you looking for in the fridge?
Just some fresh seasonings and herbs I could use, like dill and rosemary. I'm looking for some tomatoes and cucumbers to make a kind of a heated kale chopped salad that I've made before.
This is not the first time we've been in a home kitchen for this. So Chef John Adams had to cook in his mom's kitchen, and actually he got squid that day. So,
right. So at least you don't have squid. Can't even imagine.
So what are you looking for here?
I have some mint left, kind of dried. I also have some oregano here. So I'll just kind of pull off what I got. Not much, but should be enough. So I have thyme, oregano, strawberries, mint, basil. This year I had the joy of eggplant and tomatoes. And also I always have basil every year.
So the garden went pretty well until it's been kind of dry and you know, and it's a little tough. So tell me what you have.
So I have some rosemary, baby dill, oregano, and thyme.
And where are you still thinking you're going with this?
I'm going to do a Dijon mustard, white wine, crusted duck, and then I'm going to sear it and then bake it with some olive oil, and I'm going to have a chopped kale salad with it. Okay. So I'm going to do the duck first, and then I'm going to finish off with the salad. I have a lamb recipe that's similar to this one. I don't use white wine, but it is extremely similar, and I call it my herb-crusted lamb. and I serve it with Brussels sprouts and duck bacon. Nice. I'm using a dill to give it kind of a grassy flavor to really incorporate with the gaminess of the duck. So my brother got me some Evu, as Rachel would say, from Italy. He brought it all the way back from Italy for me and gave it to me. It's kind of a Christmas gift. And then I'm just going to let that olive oil heat while I prep the duck. About a tablespoon and a half of Dijon mustard. Though I'm the French chef, I use a lot of Italian olive oil. So now I'm just gonna mix it up.
So tell me why you like to work with duck.
Duck is a very French thing, and I took a duck class with my mom, and that's how I got into duck bacon. But I just really liked the kind of gaminess and saltiness of the duck. So you don't have to totally worry about under-seasoning it, but you do have to season it still. So it has a very great flavor, and it's really inspiring to Hoosiers because we're the number one duck place. Butter. Have butter. So I'm going to add a little bit of crushed mint because I love mint. Could you get the salt and pepper? Not very many kids can say that they have their first chef night at the age of 10. So I'm just doing a rough chop to not really take out all the juices of the herbs so it can help moisten that chicken. I mean, the duck. So now I'm just salting and peppering both sides. And then I'm adding my other herbs, the dill and the rosemary. All right, and then I'm about to put them in the pan. Now I'm about to start the chopped kale, and it has mushrooms and duck bacon and cherry tomatoes and cucumbers. I like portobellos because they're a little more of a wild mushroom, so they'll go well with any kind of gamey meat like the duck or... they go well with steaks, I find. And, of course, Julia loves them with steaks, with her beef bourguignon. So now I'm about to go check the duck.
So what are you looking for?
So I'm looking for a nice color on it, a golden-ish brown, a lot like an eggshell. It's not quite there yet. So now I'm going to add the mushrooms to the pan with some olive oil and, of course, butter. Now in Julia's book, My Life in Paris, she wrote about going to the Le Cornet Bleu cooking school, and she talks about how there was so much butter that it made your heart stop just looking at it.
And so now what do you have?
So now I have the kale, and I'm just chopping off the stems. And I'm just going to give it kind of a rough chop and try to remove as much of the stem as possible.
Okay, so how's the duck looking?
Ooh, looking pretty good. Kind of. But as Julia says, never apologize, no excuses. So the problem is it's sticking a little bit more than I hoped, but Julia never gave up whenever something went wrong in the kitchen. So I'm just going to give it a chop, and I'm going to add it with my mushrooms to wilt. So now I'm going to do tomatoes. So I'm just going to do a handful of tomatoes, just probably a quarter of them. And now I'm going to go check on the duck. So it's getting a nice color on it. It's kind of golden brown. It's a really tender meat, so it seems to be falling apart on me a little bit. But I'll make it work. I'm just going to finish up cutting the tomatoes and then add them to the wilting kale and the cooking mushrooms, and then I'm going to do the cucumber. Now I'm going to see how the kale is wilting. So the mushrooms are cooking nicely, and I'm just going to add the tomatoes. It gives it just that bright pop of color, and some salt and pepper also. And of course, more butter. Now we're just going to let those cook together while we chop the cucumber up. So now we're going to add this and a little bit of lemon juice to the pot. It's got some bright pop of color. So what we're looking for the cucumber is to have a little bit of a golden brown side to it. And we're also going to add some lemon.
So is this a dish that you said, you know, you make it with lamb? Is it something you particularly like?
I like using fresh herbs, one of my favorite ingredients, besides duck bacon. And I just like to use them a lot because they're fresh and they're very French, depending on which ones you use. And you can make anything French. I'm sure you can make a cheeseburger French by adding seasonings. So now I'm going to add the lemon juice. So now we're going to take the lid off. And we're just going to let them all brown together. And add a little bit more salt to help take the water out of the tomatoes.
So what do you think?
Hot. I'm getting that lemony flavor. And I'm going to add a little bit more butter, of course. And I think that it's a really great dish to use. So it can go with anything that has a very bright and colorful presentation.
Seasonal, nice, fresh.
So this is a kale salad and it has tomatoes, cherry tomatoes that are red, and you can add yellow ones too. It has portobello mushrooms, cucumber and kale, and a little bit of lemon. And then all that's been cooked, and then the kale's been wilted, and everything has got a great color on it. Nice golden brown, the cherry tomatoes really pop. And it's with butter and olive oil, and you pretty much use about a good 5 to 4 tablespoons. And then for the duck, it's rosemary, a little bit of dill, so it gives you that nice grassy flavor. And then some salt, pepper, and then some crushed mint, because I love mint. And then it's mixed with Dijon mustard, white wine, and olive oil. And it's coated with the three liquids, and then with the herbs and the salt and pepper. And then that's just cooked together for about 4 minutes on each side.
And what do you call it?
Herbs de duck, and the herbs de duck and the kale salad.
Very nice. Very nice. Thank you very much. It's lovely, too, and smells so good.
We've been cooking with Sabrina Richards of Indianapolis, who will be at the Fantastic Food Fest at the Indiana State Fairgrounds January 16th and 17th. For more information on the event, check out fantasticfoodfest.com, and you can look for Cook with Sabrina on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram.
Here we are in the middle of January, but for chocolatier Julie Boljak of Chocolate for the Spirit, that means one thing. It's only about a month until Valentine's Day. To find out what the holiday is like for a chocolatier, I stopped by her Carmel shop recently for a little Valentine's Day update. It's a month away from Valentine's Day. You are a chocolatier. What is your life like this time of year?
I'm obsessed. I'm obsessed with all things Valentine's Day. So here's the deal. People assume that in the chocolate business, per se, that Valentine's Day is huge and maybe even the hugest. The holiday season that we just came through, there's Thanksgiving rolled in there, there's Christmas, Kwanzaa, Hanukkah, parties, all that, okay? So it's a very extended period of time. And people consume a lot, plus they gift a lot. In total, that is the big time of year, okay? From a revenue perspective, that is it. Oftentimes for the gifting, people are not necessarily looking for the most gourmet of our product line, okay? So, for instance, some of the bonbons and truffles boxed very fancy, that isn't necessarily what they're looking for during that period.
Oh, no, I would have thought that would catch their eye right away. What is it that they do want?
Toffee. Overall, the toffee is probably the number one seller, but I have a couple of connoisseur bars and the Mayan spice bar, so they're sort of all run neck to neck. So people will buy, like, maybe a variety, and, for instance, a lot of stocking stuffers. So the toffee and some of the items that we sell in the $10 range are really popular, so they'll buy a lot of those. Then comes Valentine's Day. People are not purchasing from multiple people.
Oh, sure. So they're not giving presents. It's not like you have a whole a present list to give, right?
Exactly. Typically, people who are going to give for Valentine's Day, flowers and chocolate. Now, the chocolate that they give for Valentine's Day is in my wheelhouse because it's going to be more the fine chocolate.
Oh, this is the really nice present kind of chocolate, right?
Exactly. So the fancy boxes and the day after Christmas, what I did was inventoried everything that I had, and I immediately put in my orders for the special packaging that I needed for Valentine's Day, okay? So They will gift, and what they gift is going to probably be, from a price perspective and a product perspective, a higher price, a more premium product. But they're not going to be buying for as many people.
Oh, so that does that balance out then?
Well, it's one day. There's an expectation right at the last minute that they're going to walk into my place and others, and they're going to have just a fantastic, huge choice. And it's all going to be there for them.
So they expect a big selection, you know, on February the 13th, right, when they're finally getting around to doing their shopping.
Absolutely. They expect that. Now, we could have the worst snowstorm we've ever had on that day, and we wouldn't see them. And it could go on the entire weekend. And there you go. People are not going to be buying Valentine chocolates on February 15th, 16th, and 17th.
So after the holiday, they start looking for markdowns, right?
Exactly.
So this is a big this is a big timing thing for you, right? Of juggling and timing.
Yes. So, you know, so we get the packaging, and I've made in my mind, a list of what I want to make, and I also try to make something new every year. It's a fun time for me because I like to create. So it's a very creative experience, but it also is very risky, the timing of all this.
So it's all a gamble. So you have to gamble on the weather and the produce and the fact that whether people will come out. Oh, my goodness.
It is. Yeah, it's really fun. And people sort of think, oh, wow, that's your great big day. That maybe is your biggest day of the year. And it can be. It can be incredible.
Right. If you get the perfect lineup of the situation, right?
Right. So I've experienced in life that very few moments where everything has lined up perfectly. So I'm prepared to expect the unexpected.
Once Valentine's is over, tell me what you have coming up that people could look forward to. I know you've been doing some classes. So tell me about the classes that you have here at Chocolate for the Spirit.
Yes. Well, another objective of mine is to bring others on board with my journey for the pursuit of some of the world's best chocolate. Okay. A lot of the chocolate that we have experienced growing up, the beans have been bought at auctions, a low price, and fillers and artificial flavorings have been put in. And that's not what we're doing. We're working with chocolate where the chocolate itself is a star. whether you just made a solid bar of it or did something else with it, we always want to feature the chocolate. So I have classes. One's called Connoisseur 101, where we do 2 hours of information and exploration and tasting and working our way through chocolate, some of the things that are familiar, all the way to some of the world's rarest and best chocolates. And then we're also doing a build-your-own chocolate bar classes where people get to select chocolate and then a variety of ingredients to do a little bit of what I get to do as a chocolatier, which is, you know, think about what might work together.
Like the types of chocolate paired with different flavors, that sort of thing?
Yes, fruits and nuts and spices, yes, cocoa nibs, for instance. And then they get bars to take home and share. It's interesting because they make 4 bars, and so far nobody is wanting to eat the bars here. Everybody's wanting to take the bars home.
They all want to take them home and show off and see what I made and see, yes, what, see if they like, other people like it.
So we do give a little award in those classes for best of show. But because nobody wants to break any of the bars to taste, it has to be a beauty contest. It's based solely on how do the bars look.
Yeah. And what kind of combinations do they come up with?
First of all, everybody really likes spices. A lot of spices, okay? We have a full line of different gourmet salts, so they're also getting some salt in their bars. We're seeing a lot of berries, like blueberries and dried strawberries, cranberries, nuts. People are really nuts about nuts, okay?
Now tell me what the price range is on those classes.
They are under $40. Sometimes we work with Living Social and Groupon, and people can get those classes for half price or even a better deal.
Now tell me about where people can go for more information.
Well, we love our mailing list, folks, because that's the way that we know that we can connect. We are Chocolate Spirit on Facebook. The problem with Facebook, though, is Facebook is sort of cutting us off from the people that want to connect with us these days. So the sure way to connect with us is to go to our website, chocolateforthespirit.com, and then sign up for our newsletter there.
We've been talking with chocolatier Julie Boljak of Chocolate for the Spirit. For more information on Julie's artisan chocolates and what she has planned for Valentine's Day, go to chocolateforthespirit.com. Always great to see a new food entrepreneur start up in Indianapolis, especially when the backstory is as fun as Rita Franco's. She got started in her tamale business by accident and never really intended to be a business owner. But the accidental entrepreneur decided to run with it and started La Mexigringa, a small shop at 6129 East Washington Street, and now she has a rentable commercial kitchen as well. I stopped by La Mexigringa this past year to hear the story of how the business came about.
My best friend's from Mexico, and me and her would, for the past 7 years, we would be at home one weekend, and we would just make about 150 tamales and sell them just to kind of to friends and family. We'd usually do it after Christmas to make up for what we spent.
So the business took off?
Yes. Yeah, it did. I accidentally started a business because I really didn't mean to. Just some amazing people in the neighborhood found out about me, and all of a sudden my Facebook page grew from 100 to 600. So then I just decided that it's probably time to walk into starting a business.
So tell me, is this like the inspiration for your business?
So a bill came up that was due that I had not budgeted for when I was, you know, at home with my 4 kids. And I am an entrepreneur, so I was getting on Facebook and I'm like, I will prep your food, I'll clean your house, whatever you need, just, you know, help me make some money. And Garcia from 16th and Emerson with Garcia's Hot Dogs, he private messaged me and he said, amiga, make tamales. And I said, well, that's hilarious because number one, like I said, he is Mexican and he's telling a white girl to make tamales. That's funny. That was just, I feel like that was God just laughing and saying, go ahead and try this. And I did, and I put it on Facebook, and within 1 hour, I had 200 tamales sold, and I had to cut it off, and I was hyperventilating because I could barely sell 150 between me and my friend every year for 6 years prior to that. So it just took off. I mean, it just was just the right time. And that's why I say it was an accidental business. I did not know 200 tamales were about to be ordered in 1 hour.
Now, that's just nuts. So you put it out on Facebook, you know, or and that's what it took?
Yes, that was all it took. Use your Facebook, guys. If you want to build a business, use Facebook. It's awesome.
How did that go, you know, in starting a business? You know, was it hard? Was it challenging?
There's always been a burning desire in me and I knew I was an entrepreneur. So there's always been a burning desire to have a business, but I didn't know it would start so quickly. So I'm a mother of four, and I was just used to being at home, cleaning, cooking, whatever. But this is actually really fun, this business concept and all of the ventures that I've been going through to figure out how to do it is awesome.
Now, tell me about how you very first got it started, because that's kind of inspired what you're doing now, right?
Yeah. So, how I very first got started, well, I just walked into the business community not knowing a daggone thing and running into walls and trying to figure out what I was doing, feeling my way through, walking around blindly, and some amazing people have helped me out through the way.
So did you hit some snags or some difficulties that you had to navigate through?
Yeah. Well, you know, paying people too much when you don't know that you can do it for free or that there's resources out there to help you.
Well, you know, like, you know, small business resources, that sort of thing.
Yeah, definitely. There's small business resources like SCORE and BOI. Those are some huge helpers to me right now. And actually, I've started on my second venture, which connects to La Mexi Gringa, the kitchen that I'm working out of. I have now turned into a community kitchen.
Well, now tell me about that, because that's very interesting. We have so many food entrepreneurs these days, and they do need space to work, right?
So now my heart is so excited about this, because now I can help the people that are just like I was, coming out of their home, knowing that they have, first of all, a great product, second of all, a passion for culinary, the culinary, you know, world or industry, And now, I mean, I have a lot of answers now, so I can share them with people. It's so cool. And then I have this facility that I was blessed with by my stepdad.
Well, now, tell me how that came about, how you came to have your community kitchen and what it's called and where it is.
So the community kitchen came about by, it was me and my stepdad, Chef Dan, who we would work out of here together. It was his catering kitchen, and now he has moved into a restaurant in Irvington, and he allowed me to take over this space and turn it into the community kitchen.
It's on East Washington Street, right? And in a part of town where people, there's probably not a lot of resources for this sort of thing, and so I think it's probably going to hit an untapped market. So have you had a lot of interest so far?
I have definitely had a lot of interviews that I was able to find a lot of different people that are looking for this on this side of town, on the east side of town, in the Irvington-ish area, close to the south side.
Well, tell me the kind of tamales that you make, the different kinds.
Well, we play around with flavors during the fall months. We do a lot of sweets like pumpkin spice and apple pie. I've done peach cobbler. But the traditional tamales that I make are pork, with green salsa, chicken with red or green salsa. I do some bean and cheese. I do some rajas, which are veggies with some spicy peppers and cheese. Yeah.
It's great. So the neighborhood is, has embraced the business, right?
The neighborhood has embraced the business, and actually it's expanded all the way out to, I think a guy came from Geist for the holidays and bought 40 tamales from me. So they're just not easy to find in Indiana, actually. You got to know where to go to find a tamale. And I think my tamales are pretty decent, but if you ever see a little old Mexican lady sitting in a parking lot selling out of the trunk of her car, you should buy from her because they're probably way better.
Now, walk me through the basic ingredients of a tamale. What do you have here?
Okay. So the basic construction of a tamale would be you'd have your masa. You'd have your...
And explain what the masa is.
Masa is a corn dough that you are going to put in a corn husk, and you'll steam it for a Mexican tamale. And then you will, so before you do all that, you'll take your masa and you'll scoop it out and put it into a corn husk and flatten it out just a little bit. And then you will take some filling of your choice. I have beans right here. Beans and cheese is what one of the tamales that I do. If you have chicken or meat, you would take your chicken and you would put salsa on top. So you put that inside of your masa. And you'll just fold it over inside of the corn husk and roll it up, which I can show you how to do during class. And then you'll put it in a special tamale steaming pot, and they'll steam. Steam for about 20 to 30 minutes.
And that's it?
Well, that's kind of it. That's the construction of a tamale, and that's what you'll learn in Basic Tamale 101. Yeah.
But now for the classes, you've got all these things prepared for everyone, right? So they do the putting together, right?
Yes, I will show them how to make the masa so that they can go home and make masa and put whatever they want inside of it. And then the rest of it's just like a really fun cooking show. Everything's prepped for them and ready so they can put their own tamales together with no hassle and have fun.
We've been talking with Rita Franco of La Mexigringa and the Flippin' Kitchen. For more information, go to lamexigringa.com or look for it on Facebook. It's no secret that I am a big fan of the breaded pork tenderloin sandwich. It's an Indiana classic, right? So it was great fun for me this past year when I got to sit down with Indiana's tenderloin expert, Rick Garrett, and get his reaction to one of my favorites. Rick, who writes about his dining adventures at breadedtenderloin.wordpress.com, definitely knows his stuff when it comes to tenderloins.
Well, I've always loved tenderloins, and my wife and I were at a little pub in Indianapolis, 106 in College, called Jimmy B's. We'd never been there before, and I got the tenderloin and tried it. And I remember I bit into it, and I said to my wife, "Oh, my gosh, this is the best tenderloin I've ever had in my life. It's incredible." And so we talked a little bit, and she said, "You should start reviewing these." And I got to thinking there are a ton of food review sites out there, but fewer specialized. I thought, tenderloin's part of our culture.
It absolutely is. And so it really is a part of Indiana, isn't it?
It is. It is. You find some in Iowa and just a little bit, but in Indiana, it is part of our culture.
So when was that? When did you get the idea to do this?
Well, that was about 4 years ago. So I just scribbled some notes while I was sitting there eating that tenderloin and went to WordPress and formed a blog and posted it. And suddenly I started getting emails.
Well, I love that.
And a part of it was because it was kind of an unknown place. It wasn't a chain restaurant. So I tend to go towards locally owned places. And I like to go to kind of out-of-the-way places where people don't go. do hit a chain restaurant occasionally. So it just kind of blossomed from there.
Now tell me how many you've done over the past 4 years.
I've done about 150 over the past 4 years.
That's a lot of tenderloins.
I've eaten more than that. Some I haven't reviewed because they are a return visit. Some weren't worth reviewing.
Well, you know, that happens.
It does happen. But I always try to give a fair review and kind of had to learn the difference between a tenderloin and a fritter, because when I was growing up, we had pork fritters as a staple of our diet. But there's a big difference between it.
Oh, exactly. So I think people know, you know, like the frozen pork fritter. That's kind of a college staple, you know, if you don't, you know, a kind of an inexpensive item. You see them right in the freezer sections.
Right. Pete's Pride is the big one that made them up at Muncie when I lived up there.
Exactly.
I refer to those as kind of cardboard with a crust. They'll fill you up, but that's about it.
But unfortunately, sometimes that is what you get when you think you're going to get a tenderloin.
It is. And I've got to the point where I will always ask, do you have a real tenderloin or do you have a fritter? There are a couple of companies now that are doing real tenderloins, but they flash fry them. So a restaurant might order them pre-made, but they're a real tenderloin. And folks have got pretty good about telling me the truth, although I've had a couple try to pass a fritter off as a tenderloin.
So tell me what you look for when you're analyzing a tenderloin, when you see one come out from on a plate. What do you think?
Well, the first thing I look for is it in a puddle of grease, because it's hard to deep fry something without it being greasy. I've been told the secret is to kind of flash fry it, do it very quickly so the grease doesn't soak into the breading. The second thing I look for is it panned out like a hubcap and, you know.
Oh, one of the huge ones, bigger than your head kind of thing.
Because I found with those, what I like about a tenderloin is that if it's thick enough, you get the distinct texture of the breading and the distinct texture of the meat. For me, a lot of food is about texture. But with those really thinly panned out ones, they all just kind of mush together and you don't get a good flavor. You just get one crunch and a bite.
That's true. I also don't like the really thin, crispy ones that are sort of cracker-like, you know, and that's all you get is the crunch. I agree with you. I like to have the different textures, and I like to, you know, actually, you know, be able to see the meat and the breading. Now, talk to me a little bit about the breading, because I'm kind of picky about breading.
I am a little picky about breading, and I've had some that have had some really interesting breadings. I like the pretty traditional cornmeal-type breading. There's a restaurant up in Pendleton, Indiana, called The Old Trail that breads theirs with potato chips, which is pretty good for about the first half of the sandwich, but then it starts getting soggy. I've had a couple of them, and it's hard to hold the crispness for that breading, you know, through the life of a sandwich. I like to talk while I eat, so it takes a while.
I know. So you're looking for a crisp breading, but now tell me if you notice if the breading stays on. That's one of my things.
I do. I like the breading to stay on. It needs to stay on the meat. So that's not. And the other thing I look for is the shape, because you can just about always tell a pre-made one, a mass-produced one, because they're all uniform in shape. So if it comes out kind of misshapen, that's a huge plus in their favor.
Okay, so that's something to look for. Is that it's not a standardized shape? All right. Now we have to talk bun, right? You know, because sometimes you get the tiny little bun, you know, so that you know the sandwich is so much bigger than that is. Does the bun make any difference to you?
Not a whole lot. I like a traditional hamburger bun or the egg buns. I like those awfully well. I think it's easy. You look at a tenderloin and you think it's just a piece of fried meat, but they actually have a pretty delicate flavor to me. And if you get into fancy things like a pretzel bun or there's another one I can't think of off the top of my head, I think it's easy to overwhelm the flavor of the meat itself. So I look for something that's a compliment but doesn't overwhelm it, just like the breading. A lot of people will put, you know, garlic or, you know,
lots of big seasonings in the bread.
Exactly. So that kind of overwhelms the flavor of the meat.
Now, toppings. What, you have favorites?
Mayonnaise, ketchup, and onion. That's my go-to thing there. I think, again, that complements the sandwich without overwhelming it. One of the things I found in doing this is there's a lot of people that actually prefer the fritter to a tenderloin.
no, really, because you know that's just a deal breaker for me when you get the sad little frozen fritter.
It is up in Muncie. There's a restaurant called Richards. You may remember Richards restaurants from up there. They have both a hand breaded tenderloin and a fritter on their menu.
And you specify which one?
You do, and they say it's about. And here's the tenderloins.
Oh, thank you. This is great.
We've been talking with tenderloin connoisseur Rick Garrett. We'll be right back with more from Rick here on Eat Drink Indiana Radio on WFYI and WFYI.org. Talking tenderloins today with Rick Garrett, a local musician and tenderloin fan who blogs at breadedtenderloin.wordpress.com. I got the chance to sit down with Rick over lunch at Binkley's in Indianapolis and get his reaction to one of my favorites.
First off, they're both similar but not the same, so this looks like they're hand-breaded and hand-cut. I see the grill marks on them, which is a good, at least on mine. I don't see them on yours, maybe a little bit. You look like you have a lot more breading on yours than I do on mine. I prefer a little thinner breading, so this works. I see some flakes of pepper in there.
So there's a seasoned breading, because sometimes the breading just is flavorless, right? But yeah.
The thing I do is cut a little corner off. Live on the radio, they can't see what I'm doing. I'm taking my knife and fork and cutting a corner off the tenderloin.
Now, what are you looking for?
Looking for the color of the meat. It should be nice and white. It's obviously just out of the fryer. Breading's staying on, so I'll try a bite. Maybe you'll hear the crunch. Oh, that's good.
Yeah, is it?
That's really good. The breading has just enough seasoning to give it flavor, but not overwhelm the meat. The meat on this one is exceptional. Tastes like a pork chop almost.
Now, that's good, because sometimes there's not a lot of flavor to the meat. You know, you've had a lot of those tenderloins, too, I'm sure.
I have, and you can see the breading is pretty thin on mine, which is a good thing. Really, really good.
So if you could maybe tell me a few of your favorite tenderloins in and around Indianapolis?
Oh, absolutely, sure. Jimmy B's, which I mentioned earlier, is at 106th and College. Great place, little dive bar. As good as the tenderloin is, the people watching is just as good. It's a great, kind of a blue-collar working man's bar. It's a great place. It is, because it's Hamilton County, it's smoker-friendly. So if you have an aversion to smoke, you might want to go at an off hour.
Oh, now that is interesting, because in Indianapolis, of course, you know, there's the smoking ban.
Exactly. There's a place on 96th and Mud Creek Road called CR Heroes that is fabulous tenderloin. They call theirs the Hoosier Daddy, which is a large version. And I believe they have the Hoosier Mama, which is kind of a small, pared-down version.
Oh, that's kind of fun to have a different size, because some of them do get pretty big.
They do. And I love that place. It's locally owned, just like Jimmy B's. So I kind of expected a superhero theme, CR Heroes. And I walked in and saw a couple of Batman and Superman things. But the bulk of it is dedicated to local firefighters and police, which I thought was a
sure.
Really
I
nice.
Get the hero thing.
It is. It was a really, really nice place. I've always been fond of the Gaslight Inn down there at 2280 South Meridian.
Right, now that, right? It's, you know, that's a historic building, supposed to be haunted, that sort of thing?
It is. I've never had any weird experiences. I've seen some weird people in there, but I've never had any weird experiences. Muldoon's up in Carmel has a very good tenderloin.
You know, that's one that people have recommended to me, and I did try that one not too long ago. A nice, straightforward tenderloin.
It is. We're here at Binkley's in Broad Ripple today. Very good tenderloin. I would highly recommend that. The Aristocrat, just down the street from us, has a great history in Indianapolis.
So now we've talked a little bit about some of the things you look for. Are there some places that stand out to you for particular reasons, you know, on their tenderloins? Well, you mentioned, you know, the local ownership, you know, it is kind of a big thing.
It is a big thing. I always look for locally owned restaurants. John's Famous Stew, which is down on Kentucky Avenue, has a really good tenderloin, but they have one like I've never seen, and that is a tenderloin topped with stew.
Doesn't, oh, my goodness, right?
But it's topped with stew. I'm not
Is it still like a breaded tenderloin?
Breaded tenderloin, just served on a dinner plate with a big heaping scoop of stew on top of it. Personally, I'm not crazy about it, but a lot of people really rave about it. Gray's Cafeteria in Mooresville has a tenderloin and gravy, so it's got a milk gravy on top of it.
Okay, now that's kind of harkening back to what I think are the tenderloin's its heritage, you know, as a schnitzel, right?
Exactly. You know, that's where the tenderloin came from, is the accepted theory that the Germans were looking for a way to recreate the schnitzel sandwiches that they had and created the tenderloin. So.
Well, it's, you know, it sounds plausible to me. I've not really seen it proven, it may be, but to me that seems like a certainly a logical reason as to, you know, how the tenderloin developed such a following in Indiana, in Indianapolis, you know, very strong German heritage.
Exactly. Matter of fact, for my 100th review, I made the trip up to Huntington, Indiana, to Nick's Kitchen, which is the place that's supposed to have sold the first breaded tenderloin.
So that's like the tenderloin mecca, and actually, that's one I haven't been to yet.
It's pretty darn good. It's not the best I've ever had, but it was above average. And the place is just a piece of living history, a lot of local history. And I got to say, that's the best darn sugar cream pie I've ever had in my life up there. It was incredible.
Well, now they do advertise the sugar cream pies too. There's the sign in the window about the pies too.
Growing up in a small town, I have a real affinity for small town restaurants, so that's a good one. If somebody wants to make a drive, there's one I just had this weekend. I spend a lot of time in Metamora, Indiana, and there's a restaurant down there. I had not tried the tenderloin, but they have their pork grown locally. Metamora has a working grist mill right on the canal, and they use the cornmeal from that grist mill for their breading.
Oh, now that's great. Now talk about local.
Yeah. So everything's within, you know, like an eighth of a mile of the restaurant. And it was really good. They don't deep fry theirs. They do it.
Bake it?
Cast iron skillet.
Oh, it's pan fried.
It is pan fried, which gives a whole different texture. It's kind of interesting because most tenderloins are pretty much, if you talk about crunchiness and texture, they're pretty uniform all the way through the sandwich. But the ones that are pan fried tend to be crunchier around the edges and a little softer in the middle. But it worked really, really well.
Other places worth a drive to try to hit?
Fort Wayne has some really good ones up there. So there is a place in Indianapolis, the Castleton Grill, which is owned
Don Hall's, right?
So he has several restaurants up in the Fort Wayne area, so that's a good one. There's some really good ones in Muncie. There's a town north of Muncie, about 15 miles, called Albany, Indiana. It's a place called Pete's Duck Inn that has a fabulous tenderloin, really good.
What makes that one so good?
Oh, it's not pounded out. It's so the sandwich does not really extend over the edge of the bun very much. So when I first got it, I thought, oh, this isn't much of a sandwich, but it's nice and thick and incredibly tasty, and the pork is grown on a local farm up there in Albany, so everything is extremely fresh. Interesting throwback restaurant. They have frog legs, and one of the only places I know that serves Rocky Mountain oysters.
Oh, my goodness. Well, now that's a throwback.
That is a throwback. So that's up in Albany, Indiana.
Tell me where your readers are.
Well, the bulk are in the Midwest or transplanted Midwesterners. I get a lot from the United States. Indiana is number one. Florida is number two, I think because of all the retired folks from Indiana that live down there. Get a lot from Iowa, which is another big tenderloin state. It's kind of interesting because you jump across Illinois and don't find any tenderloins, and then they're really popular again in Iowa. And they're significantly different. All of the ones in Iowa, even the ones that are hand-breaded and hand-cut, are pounded paper thin.
Oh, really? Now, see, I've wondered about the Iowa tenderloins. So they're not our big, thick, you know?
They're not. So I found them in Iowa. The farthest west I have found is St. Charles, Missouri, which is just on the other side of St. Louis. And it was a darn fine tenderloin, except it was cut long and narrow and served on a hoagie bun.
Oh, now that's just wrong.
But it was a good tenderloin. Occasionally I'll find them down around Cincinnati, right where Indiana, Ohio, and Kentucky come together, but they're really pretty much a regional food.
I just find them interesting, you know, because I think it's a great representation of Indiana, you know, with pork, you know, and a German heritage. And like you said, it's a good sandwich. I mean, you have the meat, you have the crunch, so you have the different textures.
That's right. Locally raised, it's health food.
No, you can't possibly do tenderloins all the time. So what what do you do in your real life?
In my real life, well, I am a musician and a comedian after having done a lot of things during my life. Been in the ministry, firefighter, paramedic, lots of different things. Officially retired from all that. So I play music with my wife, Holly, and I do stand-up comedy. And we have a music and arts co-op in Metamora, Indiana, where we teach music and have art workshops and have a retail music store and so on. So most of my life revolves around the arts in one way or the other.
Now, where can people follow your blog or find out some more information?
Sure. The blog is breadedtenderloin.wordpress.com. I actually wanted to make it breadedtenderloin.com, but somebody owns that domain and wanted like $10,000 for me to buy it.
Oh, for heaven's sakes.
So it wasn't that important. And my personal website is Rick Garrett, G-A-R-R-E-T-T, rickgarrett.net.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you, Jolene. It's been such a treat to meet you today, and I hope our paths cross again soon.
Absolutely, over another Tenderloin.
Yes, absolutely.
We've been talking with Tenderloin expert Rick Garrett. You can find his reviews of Indiana's classic sandwich at breadedtenderloin.wordpress.com. You've been listening to Eat Drink Indiana Radio on WFYI HD 2 The Point. I'm your host, Jolene Ketzenberger. Thank you so much for tuning in this week, and thanks also to our guests, Sabrina Richards of Cook with Sabrina, Julie Boljak of Chocolate for the Spirit, Rita Franco of La Mexigringa, and Rick Garrett of breadedtenderloin.wordpress.com. And thanks also to producer John Ketzenberger for helping to bring you Eat Drink Indiana Radio.
Eat Drink Indiana Radio is powered by EatDrinkIndy.com, where Central Indiana turns to learn about food from farm to fork and drink from grains to glass.